Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to Flow Guitar Enthusiasts with Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Great tone. Everyone can tell what it is, but how do you get it? With so many styles of music, with new gear coming out almost daily, what's the secret to great tone? Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show, where we talk about tone, what it is, and how to get it. With your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill, we will talk to the creators of tone, the manufacturers, and the players, as we explore tone and the gear that gets it.
Tonight on the Flow Guitar Enthusiasts, we welcome the Burst Brothers, Drew Berlin and David Belzer. From finding super rare to the elusive Burst Les Pauls, Drew and David are one of the most recognized vintage instrument authorities. We will speak with them tonight about vintage guitars and hear some of the rare ones live in studio. Flow Guitar Enthusiasts is proudly sponsored by Sweetwater Musical Instruments and Pro Audio at www.sweetwater.com. And here are your hosts, Jeff Floro and Scott Sill.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Radio Show. We have a great one tonight. We got some great guitars in here and some great players. Scott, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. Actually, I ended up doing something over the weekend that I don't think you know about. I actually ended up picking up a Martin D28 this weekend.
Ah, the retro?
No, I did not get the retro. I got a, it's a custom, but it's nothing really major custom other than it has an Adirondack top and some Waverly tuners on it. So that's what I wanted. And it has scallop bracing.
Not the herringbone?
No, just a regular D28.
But oh, cool.
Yeah, so.
I'm jealous.
Yeah, it's a cool little guitar. So sounds amazing and it's loud as hell. So great.
I thought you were talking about a car.
No.
We always talk about guitars here. We're just guitar people.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's good.
Yeah, and then so I'll be using that actually. I'm started putting together the Audio-Technica condenser mic shootout that I'm doing.
Oh, that's right.
Well, you like were four talking different mics. About that. So that will come out and I'll do that, and then I'll have my own 28 on that also. So.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Anyway, okay, well, we want to jump in as soon as possible with this because this is a great show, and these guys have brought some guitars in, and they're going to be showing them to us. So I'm going to go ahead and go to commercial, and we'll be right back with the Burst Brothers.
Hi, Kenny Burgle here, one of the many guitar freaks at Sweetwater. We're proud to support the Flow Guitar Enthusiast Show, and we carry a huge line of custom shop and collectible guitars, pedals, and amps from the most sought-after manufacturers. Check this out, sweetwater.com/guitar gallery. You can see hundreds of custom and signature guitars and actually choose your perfect instrument by grain pattern and serial number, or call us professional guitar enthusiasts at 800-222-4700. Speaking of killer guitars, this week the Flow welcomes Drew Berlin of the Burst Brothers. The Burst Brothers are Drew and David Belzer, and they are among the most knowledgeable vintage guitar guys in the world, doing all kinds of vintage guitar sales and auctions. Have fun as Scott and Jeff discover stuff about vintage Les Pauls and other collectibles with Drew. And be sure to check us out at sweetwater.com or call us at 800-222-4700. Thanks for listening. This is Kenny Burgle at Sweetwater saying, rock on with the Flow.
Hey, this is Tracy Guns, and right now you are listening to the Flow Guitar Enthusiasts Show with Scott and Jeff. And Andy and Tracy, and we're all here partying and going nuts. Anyways, this is the only guitar show I know of that you get to listen to guitar players and manufacturers talk about the cool stuff, and you can call in and talk to them, and you're going to have a good time. Thank you.
to bring in officially the Burst Brothers here. And they are playing just a few little instruments here. That's a little 59 Les Paul and a 62 Fender Stratocaster here live on air for you guys.
Welcome, guys, to the show. It's really an honor to have you guys
Drew
here.
Drew Berlin and David Belzer. Guys, thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you for having us.
I don't think you guys need us. You know more about guitars than we do.
I don't know about that. I just talked to you guys before the show. I've learned a lot. So
scallop bracing and Waverly tuners, man.
Harry Moan. And
you guys are rocking, man.
To start out real quick, tell us what you guys are playing right now. If you guys could go through the guitar so everybody knows, because they just sound amazing.
This is Dave, and I'm playing a 62 Fender Stratocaster in kind of a beat-up Fiesta red color.
Yeah, it's a cool little red. I haven't seen a red like that before.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've heard of the... I know a couple of people have Fiesta reds, but that color is a little more red than orange.
You know, they will vary depending on the amount of sunlight they've seen and all that. And plus, this one, when they shot it in the fact, they didn't shoot an undercoat. So the undercoat on some of them will have a white undercoat. It'll actually change the color of the red, too. So they'll vary. The Fiesta red will vary a lot.
And you were saying something about the neck, that being one of the last slab boards?
Yeah, this is, if I remember, I think it's a March or April of 62, and that's just about the end when they started to go to the veneer and start curving the rosewood. So, yeah, this is one of them.
I believe that guitar sounds especially good because of the lack of the undercoat, and it's really dried out, and it's just got the vibe.
Is that Alder?
It's an old, yeah.
That's an Alder body.
Sure. Yeah, Alder body.
Brazil. I know a lot of the newer Strats, everybody likes the ash, but the Alder Rosewood, Alder Maple, to me, was always the sound of the Strat.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, you can get some that have, if you get a blonde Strat, you'll get a blonde Strat has an ash body with a slab board or something, and it's a different sound. It's definitely a different sound than the Alder.
Dave and I got the 12-hour tour of Fender not too long ago, and man, they're making some nice stuff. Had some really impressive stuff that old vintage guys like us can appreciate.
That's cool. Now, what are you playing there? You have just some simple little Burst guitar?
Yeah, this is what we're known for. This is a 1959 Gibson Les Paul Standard Sunburst Flame Top without a whole lot of flame, but it's got a lot of soul.
Well, actually, when you twist it a little bit, you see it coming down the sides.
We call that trying. It's trying. If you stand on your head in the right light, you might be able to see a little bit of it.
If Mars and Venus kind of collide. Yeah.
But some of the original ones, the flamier.
It's right here.
They weren't super flamey. Mm-hmm. And when we did our run of Burst Brothers guitars, we made sure that we didn't have them too flamey because they weren't realistic. So we did two runs, and they were more like this, where a lot of the guitar collectors and not the players wanted, we want flame, and the guitar players said, we just want a guitar to sound and play good. So we weren't trying to impress anyone with flame. We just wanted a guitar that the neck felt right and that had a vibe that guitar guys that actually use them for a living would be into, not the as much, for the collecting guys.
And now this one's had a few modifications over the year, but but otherwise, is it pretty much original?
Well, it's an original guitar. It hasn't ever been broken or anything, but it's been refretted. The tuners are original Clouson tuners. It's got oversized frets, probably because they wore down. This guitar has had two different Bigsby's. You can see one set of Bigsby holes here and another set here.
One wasn't enough. Had to have two.
So, only in America. I mean, you got to have.
But weren't the fat frets common to that model? It wasn't until the Fretless Wonder came out that they had the thin frets.
Well, actually, it was the other way around. The Fretless Wonder, they referred to that with the Les Paul Custom, which was a guitar with an ebony board and double binding. It was their high end model, but Les wanted to, since he was a jazz guy, he wanted like low flat frets so he could move on the neck. The Standard had a little higher rounder frets, and until 59, they got bigger. So from up until 59, they were even on Standards. They were on the smaller side. 59, they were common size. So you actually technically you're correct, but this has even beyond that. I call these speed bumps, which which, you know, a lot of guys do. A lot of guys really want to get under the strings. I'm not one of those guys. I got this guitar like it is, but it sounds so good and feels so good, I didn't want to really change it. But I wouldn't have selected this larger fret. But guys that play every night, you know, they like to refret their guitars and put the fret wire that they personally feel comfortable with. So because this guitar isn't minty fresh and perfect to refret, it's not that big of a deal.
Yeah, no, I had a 71, I built 71 Les Paul Custom that I had Valdez rework, and he shaved the neck, pulled the heel out, and he put the fat similar to those, right, which was great because I could really bend after, I could grab them real easy.
Right, I have some, I had a 56 Custom that I had for years that I was in denial about refretting, and I'd hand it to someone, they would just like hand it back to me. I can't play this thing, it's got no fret. So I finally had Roger Giffen refret it years later. But yeah, these are a little too big, but it works. The guitar works good. It's a light guitar. It stays in tune real well.
Yeah.
And you know, there's, as you guys know, and as you guys talk about, there's the collector guys that have to have everything exactly like it left the factory. And we support that. However, we're players, and so we like guitars that are set up for us to play. And so, you know, there's a fine line between both of those worlds, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've had a guy where I said, you know, like a $400,000 guitar, I said, you can't touch it, you can't put frets in. He goes, I'll do whatever I want, man. I'll buy another one for $400, you know. So, you know, it's up to the individual. We like to keep them original if you can. I think Dave's guitar is pretty much stock. I don't know.
No, it's been refretted.
Refretted.
You know,
okay.
Because Fenders especially, they always had thin frets.
Right.
I mean, up until 65, where Gibson in 59, they started going wider. But Fender didn't get it going until about 65. So it's hard to find a Fender Strat that hasn't been refretted. Yeah. Because from a player's standpoint, those small frets are... they're tough to bend. They're tough to get around. They're, you know.
Yeah.
On a Fender, you know, because...
Roger Giffen. Roger. 15 years ago or whatever.
The lack of binding on the Fender neck makes it easier to replace the frets. So when you have binding like this, as you can see, these are sitting on top of the binding. Yeah. Like really good guys like Jim Foote at Music Works, he can kind of tuck it into the binding where it looks and feels, you know, original. Yeah. Although, you know, he will indicate that it's...
Valdez rebound mine, and then he shaped it so the binding
met with
the fret and matched it. He really did a nice job.
Well, there's also guys out there that are, you know, that are really trying to pass stuff over on people that they go, oh, it's not refretted, but, you know...
There's guys that do really good work, and, you know, if a guitar needs the frets...
Yeah, if it's, the frets are worn and you can't play.
The analogy is if your car's tires are old and bald and flat, you can't drive it, you put tires on it. That's the same thing with frets. I mean, it does make it a little different. And there's purist guys that I know that I have a lot of respect for that actually will refret with old fret wire, thinking that sound is better. And, you know, it was a different material back in the 50s and 60s than they use now. It's a little more brittle and it's hard to find. Dunlap did make a fret wire at one point, I think, and stopped making it in the mid-70s that was more traditional material that was softer. So there are guys that will take frets out of a guitar that they're not using and replace that into a burst.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So let me ask you, when you guys find a burst like this, I mean, how detailed do you get? Like, for instance, on this one, I assume you know what kind of color the pickups are inside of it. If they're zebra or they're white or black. And how detailed do you guys get for someone that's going to buy this?
Well, because the guitars are so expensive and we have to be correct, we really have to forensically inspect the guitar and know and point out everything that we know. I mean, if there's something Dave and I work together. One of the good things, if he overlooks something, or if I overlook, we have the two of us to check.
Two sets
ourselves.
Of eyes definitely helps. But yeah, the one thing about Gibsons is they're a little easier than Fenders.
Really?
Well, yeah, because the neck's bolted on. I mean, it's not bolted on. It's
glued on.
Glued on there. I mean, it's, you know, somebody didn't take that neck off and put another one on there.
Right.
That's a parts guitar that you can put in a box and reassemble.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That, except for taking off the back plate and taking the pickups out and looking under the truss rod cover and all. I mean, the things you really need to... I mean, there are guys that can make incredible guitars out there and
right.
make them look old. There's certain things you have to look at, like the material, like Drew was saying. They didn't make this binding material. They don't make that nowadays.
So somebody can't reveal that.
It's not, you know, somebody's either going to have to take that off an original guitar or a 335 or an SG or something at that, you know. There's
We've seen guys that have made bursts, and then they steam off the binding, and they put the whole Brazilian rosewood board and binding on another guitar, like from an SG or something.
So let me ask you this. So, I mean, the Burst is obviously holds this legend status. Really, what is the difference? What changed, other than the color, from a 58 Les Paul gold top versus this?
Well, some of the 58s didn't have a maple top. The ones with the maple top, the difference is the winds on the pickups are a little different,
mm-hmm.
and the necks are not quite as fat as they got into 58. 57s are a little thinner necks, closer to 56s. 58s, the necks got bigger, the heel got bigger in 58.
You know, little structural things, but the pickups, too. The pickups in a 57 or a 58 are different than a 59. In mid-59, those pickups...
And why is that? I mean, why did just Gibson hire a different person?
It's the quality of the material, the quality of the magnets. They had that particular quarter of the year. It was the quality of the wiring. It was a combination of all those things,
I think Seymour Duncan pointed out to me many years ago that because of the waste factor at Gibson, that these guys would start the winding machines on the pickup, walk away and have a smoke or take a break and come back and go, that looks like enough. So in 60, they put an automatic shutoff. When it had a certain amount of winds, the machine stopped. So they were more even. Some people like 60 pickups better. It really doesn't matter.
Later 60, early 60, when the magnet gets a little shorter, too. The magnet size changes. But it's always...
The humbucker pickup, did it? Did they just make, like, one humbucker? I mean, did they make it different for the Les Paul as opposed for the ES-335?
No, the only thing would be like a Birdland. They had the spacing of the pole pieces a little closer for a Birdland, and I think that was the only
double neck.
And the double neck, if they made something special,
like a half guitar
or a mandolin, you've seen electric mandolins with PAF pickups, but they'll have four little pole pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But the magnet's the same. The material, the Alnico.
And, of course, you guys mentioned the color of the pickups. Sometime in 1959, when they ran out of black dye, they used white dye. So you'll see one coil white, one coil black, or two, they're called double whites or zebras. And because a lot of the guys that are our guitar heroes that we saw play Burst without the pickup covers on it, if they had a white or a zebra or double whites or whatever, we would all think that's cool. We didn't know to undo the screw in the back and look. We just popped the covers off to see what was under there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why so many of these guitars, the covers have been on solder. Because not until, I didn't know until like the 80s that you could just pull the screw in the back and see, shine his flashlight in there, see if it's white or black. And if it's black, kind of leave them on. And then there was also the theory that I bought into that they sound better without the covers, you know. For years, I
a lot of people claim that, but I remember too, a lot of my friends that did that, they got more interference, obviously, because the shielding.
Yeah,
there was a reason for it.
One of the interesting things I think that were the reason all of us love this so much is they're all different. You can't say if the covers came off this, if it's better or worse or whatever. Each top on a Gibson Sunburst is going to have its own thumbprint. There's not going to be another identical top to this. You just can't do it. They'll be similar from a similar batch of wood, but...
That's part of the uniqueness of the Sunburst Les Paul is not...
Yeah,
no,
it's amazing how much
same.
The wood affected the top.
Exactly. And it's not only because it's flamey, it's just because they're all unique.
I mean, one of the things I mentioned just before we had gone on the air while you guys were warming up was how quiet these guitars are. Because, I mean, my Strat buzzes, and my Les Paul buzzes even with humbuckers, and these things are just really quiet.
You got to realize the quality of these pots. They don't make pot. You're going to have to spend $50 to get this quality pot nowadays. You're not going to get that in a new guitar.
The wiring quality.
Yeah.
And I think, as one of my close friends pointed out, is guys now on the production line, and there's a lot of sweet people at Gibson and Fender. We know a lot of these guys and their friends, but there's always a guy that's medicated or, you know, uninjured. In the 50s, the level of craftsmanship and the level of caring about an American product, let's put our heart and soul into this. And they really did that on the Burst Brothers model when we had those done. Mm-hmm. They put love in it. They cared. And that's why they came out so good. But in general, there's guys now that are like wanting workman's comp. And so you get one or two weird guys in there that'll, you know,
well, it's,
every
nowadays,
day is a Monday.
They're not trying to make $400 guitars a month. They're trying to put out $400 guitars a day.
Right.
What's happening. So, you know, that's the difference.
Well, we talked about the new Fenders. What do you think of the reissues? How do they compare?
Yeah, they've gotten better and better and better. There's a lot of them are smoking guitars. I think we went through a period of time in the 80s and obviously 70s was the worst in 80s, but they started figuring it out in the 90s and it's gotten better. Both Gibson, Fender, Martin, they're making really nice products, and you can just pick up a brand new Fender guitar, set it up the way you like it, and use it a little, break it in. A perfect story, Buddy Guy. I was delivering two slabboard Strats similar to Dave's, only Sunburst, to the Rolling Stones, and Buddy Guy was opening for him. So he said, "What do you got there in those cases?" I go, "I got these Fender guitars." He goes, "Let me see them." So I hand him one. He goes, "That's a pretty nice guitar. How much?" And I go, "Well, it's $40,000. And he hands me his polka dot guitar, and he goes, "This is $100. And I go, "Yeah, but your Buddy Guy, in your hands, it's going to sound the same. It's a Carpenter, not the Tool." But realistically, you know, you can get a good guitar for cheap from Fender and from Gibson that are going to sound fine and play good. You set them up right, they'll play good. They kind of figured it out now, how to retro, you know. It's
a bolt on a neck and a body. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It only took them 50 cents.
They went back to four bolts, not three.
Thing I always liked about Fender was you could fix them. So whether you replaced the pickups, the bridge, if you wanted a brass bridge, if one were sustained, the nut, you could always do something to it.
I can put this guitar up here, and if it falls over, it's not going to break.
Yeah,
well, if this guitar falls over, it's going to be an expense.
And that's one of the brilliant things that Leo did was he goes, "Oh, the neck wears out, you unbolt it, bolt another one on." Oh. You can do it at a gig. You can do it in between sets.
Yeah, I think Stevie Ray Vaughan, didn't he have like multiple necks throughout his career, right?
You
wear necks out. If you play it every night for a few hours, you wear a neck out.
But you'll probably wear this out before you break it.
Right.
Yeah.
These are like pretty much.
Well, even Hendrix mixed them. Well, he threw his guitars around, but he mixed and matched.
Stevie Ray skated on his, and it seemed to hold up just fine.
Yeah, I know.
Sat
there and stuck his boot on it.
Townsend stopped using Fenders because he couldn't break them. He couldn't break the guitar on stage. It was like, I can't.
But yeah, Fenders are known for being stable and holding up and not being able to. These are a lot more fragile. Gibsons, especially like 335s and arch tops where there's thinner wood. But this is, you know, these things, you could probably throw it across the room and it'll stay in tune.
So when you guys are going to look at a guitar that someone's trying to sell and you guys are going to acquire, what are some of the things you look for to kind of verify its authenticity, that it's real, or what are some of the giveaways that it's been messed with?
Well, we have a pretty good eye from experience. We've seen guys open cases to where we just...
I think like most things, if you've done something long enough, you just get a sixth sense of a color, or there's something about the smell. I mean, there's a certain smell to the rings. I mean, there's guys that have actually copied these rings so well now. Now, these plastic rings around these pickups are worth more than the pickups are.
Wow.
Am I right?
That's correct. And
they're rarer.
And they only made them for this, for Sunburst Les Pauls. The rest were black.
Yeah. So they're a rare thing to have. They only go with this guitar. So, you know, you're looking at $4,000 a ring. So somebody's going to try to fake a ring. But you tell the difference is the smell, because there's a certain acetone smell to that 50s that you're not going to smell in a modern material.
It's mentioning the smell, that brings up
to that material.
Brings up an interesting topic that you guys were part of. The one thing I remember the most about the Les Paul auction that you guys participated in was the smell of that auction house from all of his stuff. And actually, I have one of his amps, and it smelled my guitar room up like I assume how his house must have smelled. It was just amazing.
You can't imagine.
Les Paul built his house out in the woods on a river, and he kept throwing up new additions and new rooms, and he was more in a hurry than he was getting it airtight and waterproof. So there was parts of his house that attracted moisture, and so
let's just say Les hung on. He didn't throw anything out.
Yeah, it's kind of obvious from that documentary Chasing Sound when he walks through his house. So actually, I'll have to talk with you guys later, but I want to figure out. I think the amp that he has sitting in his kitchen with like a pile of papers on top of it is the amp that I bought.
You bought the twin?
I bought the one of the newer twins.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's sad. I found it. It was one of the last pieces I found in the house walking through the kitchen as the moving men were going. And I go, what's up with this?
Yeah, because
that's the amp he would use in the kitchen. You know, that was, and it was cool. Just plugged in. You know, to this one strip with like eight other things. And I wheeled it out and it went into the movie. Yeah, that was in his kitchen.
I don't think we even Dave and I spent a week there and loaded up semi-trucks and spent over a year cleaning the stuff and working with the stuff and being with it between his house.
It was about a 9-month project, from start to finish.
But we don't even comprehend if you really get into what Les Paul, who he was and what he did. I mean, we wouldn't be listening to music the way we do. The Les Paul guitar is great, and the invention of the guitar, the solid body guitar that he did. But the multi-track factor and the genius factor that Les was, were always searching and always going. He's one of the greatest inventors of all time, in my opinion, for audio, for guys like guitars.
Multi-track. He designed it.
That machine, that two-track that he drilled and put the head in. We that one wasn't part of the auction, but we did move it around several times. It was like the Holy Grail.
Oh, that was the one that... Bing Crosby bought
the
it, right?
The original amp. Yep. Yeah,
it was. It's in the Smithsonian, or it was going to the Smithsonian, where it should be. But Les was an incredible, incredible, incredible guy, and I just don't think that we even get it yet. Like, it's going to take 100 years to go, oh my God, that guy, really? That guy did all that? So we're so honored that we were chosen to have such a big part in that, and it was a real privilege for us, and it was really exciting and one of the highlights of my career, for sure.
Now, when you guys walked in that house and as you went through everything, what was the one thing that you found? Was it that two-track recorder that just kind of like blew you away to actually see in person?
Dust. A lot
the
of
dust.
Dust.
Really?
No. It's hard to say because there was so much
stuff.
There was.
I mean,
in every crevice of
five semi trucks that
we
packed up,
and that's after about several dumpster loads before the semis got there.
Wow.
For me, I would have to say, being a Gibson guy and a Les Paul guy, it was his original Les Pauls that they made for him in '58 with the flat tops,
the black and the white.
Oh, wow.
The black and the white, because those were one of a kind. That was unique.
Yeah, and those didn't actually sell for as much as some of the other stuff did.
No.
But it seemed like there was one guy that was buying all those recording Les Pauls.
Yeah. I don't know. I agree with Dave. Those were the most special guitars, and there was one that was held back that wasn't sold. Remember that one that they showed
there's
at
a couple.
The end?
There's a few.
But to me, I got to say, it was that multi-track thing, because I've been trying to... being a little kid, to have one tape recorder and then recording on that, and then taping that, plus me playing on another tape recorder and trying to create multi-track, as a kid, I've got to say that recorder to me is the most historic, iconic thing of the whole collection that impressed me the most. I got goosebumps when I had to touch it and lift it and move it. I didn't think I was worthy. I didn't even want to touch it. But
wasn't Les the one that developed Sound on Sound?
Yeah, that's what it is. Multi-tracking. Yeah, so there's a you can probably pull it up on YouTube. But there's a demonstration of Les Paul saying, "Hi, I'm Les Paul, and I'm going to explain what multi-tracking is, Sound on Sound. Here's Les Paul, and now here I am on the other channel." And so he's talking now. Now I'm going to play this part. Now I'm going to play this part. So he plays the rhythm on one track. He plays a solo on the other. He goes, okay, now that sounds like two guys playing. That's just me. Now I'm going to do this too, and I'm going to do that. And And so it broke it down to explaining exactly what sound-on-sound multitracking is, that you can make tracks and play them back at the same time. And that's... Yeah.
But, I mean, the technology now where they have the looper pedals where people just do loops, that's where it came
from.
Well,
one of his other inventions was delay, right? That was his Les Paul sound, was delay.
Well, he used
which kind
of
blew
of
people
effects,
away.
Right, with the delay. There was a guy named Butts in Ohio that did the Butts amp that was made famous both by Chet Atkins, and of course Scotty Moore did all of Elvis solos on that, where he had an actual tape, pinch rollers and a tape rolling around the bottom of the cabinet that was a tape echo. But there's a lot of things, and of course, you know, if you knew Les, he took credit for inventing everything, but there's a lot of stuff that he really did, and he was an incredible guy that he didn't sleep much. He just
invented,
you know. And Dave's favorite thing is the way he would take like a beautiful blonde Super 400
and just destroy it,
just cut the whole back off it, and just start start going for it
and just leave it.
a lot of the projects were projects, you know, that were halfway done and in the process, you know, he was a mad scientist. He was incredible.
Yeah.
He was, there'll never be anyone.
He was searching for the sound of that one Epiphone. And he had it in that one Epiphone.
He had three of those, actually.
Yeah. The one. The clunkers?
The clunkers. Like that clunker one or two. Whichever one. That it did sound amazing, clunkers.
At the very end of the show, at the auction, you were there, when everybody got everything and everything was going off, there was a guitar. When Dave and I first went to Les's house, there was a clunker on the bed without pickups in it, like a couple of strings off it, and it was just kind of just holes and a hole in the back, but it had that aluminum bracing that he used, the suspension system, and it was just sitting there, and I go, this has to be like one of the clunker, the experimental model, where he tried all these different pickups and electronics on. And so they bring it out the very end of the auction. Everybody's high-fiving everything they got. And I'm like, wait a minute. So I bought it, and I got it reasonable. And then after the auction, we had a couple guys like Rob Lawrence, who spent a lot of time, did a Les Paul book. He goes, you know, I'm like, well, cool. I did enough work on this. I deserve to get something. I'll take it. So it's a clunker. Not one of the most famous ones, of course, but a clunker that he did his experimenting with. And it's kind of interesting how he had his taste in pickups and in pots. And you're right, it was that Epiphone that started the whole thing. The Epiphone that started it had what's called a barn door, that you could access the electronics from the arch top, opening the back up, the back swung open. So he just... That's what he did. He cut the backs, the ones that he couldn't find like that. He just cut the backs, cut a hole, you know, a door in them himself.
Yeah, it was. If it wasn't him, it was. It would have been almost sacrilegious to see it. You know, it was crazy to see the stuff he had. I remember there was this beautiful Les Paul there that had like perfect flame. Everything about it was great, and it just mystified me because I wanted to know, because there was just a wire hanging out of it. It looked like almost kind of like an antenna.
Yeah.
And I was like, what the hell was he doing with that? And you just wonder if it even played. Like, you just wonder what the heck is inside of it.
We have to remember, though, that they just gave him guitars to experiment with. To him, it was like, okay, another work piece.
Yeah, send me three of these.
We didn't know. I mean, back then, they would have never thought that those guitars would be collectible if they were
But,
pristine.
You know, he looked at all those guitars. I mean, there were 300 guitars in his bedroom, and he looked at all of them. He felt it was his responsibility to at least play the guitar, and if his name was on it and all. And he would put little notes. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people got guitars, and there are little notes in those cases and all. They were all Les.
We were very careful to keep them. He was so thrifty that he would use the back of, like, advertising or flyers or whatever.
He just threw nothing out.
He was a recycler, so you see a note this big saying, back pickup, not as strong as the front. It needs this, should have that. Eighth fret needs to be taken down. You know what I mean?
If you turn it over, it's going to be a coupon from...
right. Dry cleaners or whatever. Yeah.
Well, and he had masking tape on everything. That's actually what I found inside my amp, was I found one of the numbers, because he numbered everything with masking tape. And it was sitting there laying inside of the amp. But I was like, oh, cool, I do have one of the masking tape.
Yeah.
So, it was cool.
It was so cool.
What did you? The only the one thing that he was really big on later on was the low impedance Les Paul.
Yeah.
And it never did take off. What do you think? Because, I mean, it was a pretty clean guitar.
Amazing that the one guitar that he played that he liked, Les Paul-wise, no, it couldn't give him away. Couldn't sell that model.
Well, you're right. And he didn't like binding. Everything he played had a Bigsby, no binding. And, see, because from what I understand is he started with such primitive beginnings, like a record player needle trying to pick up a guitar. That he was going for clean, clear.
That, sure. Yeah, that was a big thing.
And that was, that was
But actually, one of our friends, who's one of the top producers in town, Rhett Lawrence, bought one of the recording models, and he came with test gear, and he played five or six of them. He found the one that sounded the best. He actually tracked with it and everything and found one that was one of the better ones. And he's actually got that thing working. He's got, I hooked him up with Les's guy. He's using the same strings that Les used. And he's got that recording now, and he's using it to record all of his records with, and it sounds great. It's not easy. You gotta kind of know what you're doing, and to get those things working, you can't just plug them in and expect to get. But the one thing that he didn't get was, you know, guys taking one of these and putting them through a 100-watt Marshall, turning it up to 10 and getting that sustain. He didn't, that wasn't...
Well, Les was all about high-fidelity sound, and then rock and roll came around. And rock and roll had very little to do with high-fidelity sound. It had to do with cranking, you know, and that was it.
These weren't meant to be what we use them for now, but sure worked, though. Sometimes...
I remember when I saw that, when those came out, the recording came out, the biggest thing is like, how am I going to use my pedals? Because there was high impedance.
Right.
But it's true, the humbucker, I know that the humbucker, if you played it really hard, it'll actually distort a little bit. That was part of its sound.
Well, yeah, but you know, the real thing, the real true PAFs are very clean, headroomy pickup. It's that amp that's driving it. You know, the Gibson pickups nowadays that they tend to put in all those burst buckers and hum, you know, they tend to be very gainy right from the beginning. They tend to miss that PAF.
Well, that was the thing with the DiMarzios. The PAFs were, you know, they didn't have the output, but that's why they had that tone.
That sound.
They had more tone.
Well, I think since we're kind of getting not to the end of the show, but we're kind of more in the middle of the show, let's have you guys play again and let's hear these guitars. So you guys got another song you want to break out?
Okay. You want to do something fast or slower?
Whatever you want. You're the singer.
Okay.
Come on, one more. Come on, come on.
spell, baby. Do you know I'm free, 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 free? I'm free from your spell, baby. And now that it's all over, all I can do is wish you.
Real quick, though, now that amp that you're using, now everything that he's doing, he's getting a little bit of distortion. They're playing through this little Fender Champ. What year was that? Is this
59.
59, and this was reworked by Dumble?
Dumble did, yeah. He just kind of changed some parts.
He did
a little.
But
fairy,
I mean,
we call it fairy dust.
Because I just want everybody to notice when you hear this back, when you play this show back again, all the sustain is that they're not really playing very loud at all. And there's a little bit of clipping when you were pushing it,
well,
which was cool.
Well, I am using a TS-808
He's cheating.
Which is an original. Okay.
Well, I'm a Strat competing against the
Les Pauls. No, that's cool. But, I mean, the sustain, a lot of the stuff that both of you guys, I mean, you're holding these notes and it just sustains forever. I mean, that to me
it's
is
the guitar, you know. It's,
they're good.
You know,
good. I mean, that you can
it's all the players. It has nothing to do with the instruments. It's all us.
Well, that's true too. No.
So, speaking of amps, so what do you guys look for in vintage amps? So, what are you looking for when you're out there looking for those sort of things?
We have similar taste in amps. We're fortunate enough to be really good friends with Mr. Dumble, who has the most respect of anybody, as far as my opinion. He's taken with Fender and Marshall and everything, but he's got his own thing that he doesn't copy anybody else, and he's a pretty much genius guy that's got an incredible ear, plays extremely well and listens very well, and he just has the magic combination. And when you're blessed to have the ability to play out of a Dumble amp, your chops and your feeling, and I mean, when I have a gig, I just can't wait because I get to play through the Dumble amp. You know, that it's a whole experience in itself that you can't compare with any other amp, in my opinion.
With the average vintage amp.
Because a Dumble amp, a new one, is more than a vintage.
You just can't even
fathom. Well, now there's vintage Dumbles now, too.
You can't even fathom. Yeah, it's a Ferrari.
Yeah, I mean, I generally use Marshalls. Dave generally uses Fenders if we're not using Dumbles.
But,
you know,
if you're talking vintage amps, as far as people out there to look for it, amps are a little different than guitars, I think, at least. I don't mind if an amp has parts changed in it if it sounds great. Right. It's kind of like a vintage acoustic guitar.
Same thing.
It could have a crack, it could have this, but if you strum that chord and you go, whoa, that thing just...
That's it.
Like a cannon. I don't care. It's got to repair this or that or whatever. Kind of like that with amps too.
Chain speaker.
I mean, an amp
speaker.
Could be 100% original, but it could. You know.
Yeah. Now you're a Fender. You're a Fender guy with Fender amps. What do you think of Fender JBL? Does it matter to you?
You mean a Fender amp with
JBLs?
A JBL speaker in it? You know what? One of my first amps gigging with was a Music Man. I threw a 12-inch JBL because I'm an EV guy now. I like that clean headroom.
Mm-hmm.
I can make an amp distort.
Right, right.
I want that, you know, that purest, cleanest.
Because, I mean, in the day, the D120 was the one with the twin.
It's a great speaker. Yeah. I have one of those in my bass amp, one of my bass cabinets. But JBL, I mean...
I'm probably Fender-wise, I'm more CTS or Oxford speaker.
Ah, the Oxford, yeah.
And I just take those things out and put in Celestians.
Right.
I'll be honest with you, the Celestians.
My first gig with Drew, I was playing a 210 Vibralux, and I think he had a 100-watt Marshall.
50.
That was a 50-watt Marshall, but, you know.
Marshall.
No, I got a Pro Reverb, because at least I could kind of keep up with you.
Right, but...
So do you guys have like a story of like buying a vintage guitar that kind of just, it's kind of that classic story, you know, you hear about the Pearly Gate story that, you know, Billy Gibbons talks about. Do you have something like that?
Well, we keep you here all night, dude. We've got stories like you wouldn't believe. I mean,
what's the one that comes off the top of your head when I mention that?
I remember buying a Burst in a McDonald's in a New York Thruway.
New Jersey or Connecticut somewhere.
We bought two custom color Strats in a Burger King outside San Francisco.
Oh, did we ever?
Taking them apart on the table.
At like 1 in the morning.
It was late.
Yeah, I mean, we've done, you know, we were doing this together for close to 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And we were really going for it. We wanted to have the best inventory, the best guitars. One thing that we never compromised with is, like Dave was mentioning with the amps, if they didn't sound good, the guitar had to be a good guitar. It didn't matter that it was clean. I mean, it did matter, but if the guitar sucked, we were not that excited.
We always played everything. We tried to play everything to make sure they were good guitars.
And it helped when it was clean and straight and original and all that. But we targeted good guitars, and most of our clients were guitar players, producers. We sold to a lot of collectors as well, but like really good guitar players who knew guitars and knew that if we found something, that it would probably be a damn good guitar, generally. You know, there's very few clunkers that we... Small clunkers.
Yeah.
Very few guitars that we would buy just because there was supposed to be something and they didn't just quite make it. But But we had some incredible times. I mean, I guess the Eric Clapton collection when we bought Blackie and Lenny and Cherry was
one of the highlights. I was going to ask about Lenny, because that's about the only Stevie Ray Vaughan guitar that's ever been sold. So how did that even come about? Like, did he give it away or something?
Eric asked the Vaughan family to contribute something.
I think because it was going to Eric Clapton's Crossroads and it was for rehab, rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. I think that meant something to the family. And
So the family did donate that
one.
Oh,
of course. Yeah. Everything at that Clapton auction, even Christie's commission and everything went to charity.
I just didn't realize they actually let one go in the family.
Yeah, the family.
I remember we had seen the guitars at the Dallas Guitar Show. We put on a vintage guitar show because Eric wanted that for his Crossroads Festival. And actually, Dave came up with the idea, you know what? We should buy these guitars, like Blackie. And
I figured Guitar Center had a little extra.
Yeah, I mean, he said, you know, why don't we buy these? You know, and I'm like, that's a brilliant idea. Let's buy them. But when we after the auction at Christie's, they were handling these guitars with white gloves.
This is a good story. And, this is classic.
And then at the end of the Christie's auction, where we, I guess, after the third or fourth buy that we did, there weren't a lot of people that wanted to compete with us because they knew we would keep going, that we had deep pockets. Mm-hmm. We had, you know, prearranged to designate a certain amount of funds to buy these guitars. We wanted to make sure that we got Blackie, Lenny. The Cherry 335 was our favorite that we got, and of course the George Harrison Martin. But at the very end of the auction, we were pretty close with Lee Dixon, who was Clapton's tech for years, and we're up there, and Lee is super, super sensitive about people handling Eric's guitars incorrectly or handling them at all or anything. So we have a line of people waiting to come up and congratulate us and shake our hand, you know, congratulations on buying these guitars. And they Lee is facing us, and we're looking at backstage. We're on the stage looking backwards, and Lee's facing forward. And behind Lee's back, they wheel out one of those laundry carts with like material, like cloth material on wheels. And they took the 335 Cherry, which is which was the best guitar that we bought and the most fragile. And the janitor took it and dumped it in the sink upside down. And we're looking at each other, and we ran over there and flipped it back. But if Lee would have seen
it, was
that,
like something out of a Carol Burnett like skit. Right, I mean, just here's the maid coming in after everything's done and the white gloves are gone, sweeping up, and they've got the laundry bin.
And frozen in.
Just toss the guitars in and start wheeling them away. It was classic.
We ended up getting, when we finally got these delivered to us in Hollywood. I remember I opened up the Lenny was in kind of like some kind of weird metal.
Oh, it had a big anvil case.
Road case, but it was kind of a, you know, army, you know, it was weird, an uncommon case. And I opened the case up, picked it up to see, you know, if it made it all right. And I sat down, and even though it had like 12s on it or whatever, and I played it, and I completely got the vibe. I got goosebumps. It was so weird. I felt I was not worthy enough to play this guitar. And I put it back in the case, and we ran into Jimmy Vaughn at a show, and he goes, "Hey, thank you guys for buying that. You know, I'm glad, you know, we raised the money and everything," and we thanked him. And then he goes, "You know, I never touched that guitar. It sat in that case, and I was afraid to touch it or look at it or do anything. We just left it in the case." So yeah, it had some magic.
Had a lot of money.
That's cool. That's very cool. Well, we're coming to the end of the show here.
It goes by real fast.
We want to have you guys play out, so we want to definitely thank Sweetwater for sponsoring the show. And next week we have a really cool show. We have Brent Mason, the sound of country.
And real quick, I want to mention drewberlin.com and theburstbrothers.com.
Yep.
And also the studio, bambooRecording.com.
That's correct.
Yep. So you check it out. The picture of this Les Paul is on here. I'm looking at it right now. It switches around.
And if you guys want to meet these guys in an In-N-Out or a McDonald's and bring them a burst, they will happily do it. I bet they'll buy you a burger,
or a
too.
Or double meat cheese, too.
There you go.
There you go.
I'll take just the bun for myself.
Yeah, so next week is Brent Mason, and then we'll have a special guest of Brian Wampler will be with him, too. So that'll be a really cool show next week. They'll be on the phone. So, again, thanks, Sweetwater.
Yeah, we'd have to have you back again. into.
You guys are really interesting because you know this stuff really well, and it's good to hang with guys that love it and appreciate it and have passion for it like we do.
Oh, yes, guys. Thanks so much for
having us. Thank you guys so much. Hey, before you go, what guitar are you guys looking for that you hoping our listeners may have and want to sell?
You know, anything that's a good guitar that someone wants to part with, we're the guys to call. We'll take a look at it. We're very fair as far as what we pay.
Or even if you have some questions, we can help you out.
All right, well, give him a ring, and why don't you guys play that little burst and, you know, the little 62 Strat there for us.
What do you want to play?